In the garage of Dr. Frank Conrad, on November 2nd, 1920, the first scheduled pre-advertised radio program in the United States went on the air. Station KDKA was broadcasting returns of the presidential race on the evening of Election Day. From a humble beginning in a Pittsburgh garage to the sumptuous studios of the national radio networks in New York, Chicago, and Hollywood, these are the years we refer to as the Golden Age of Radio.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing your
time. Al Kemp on the air for Griffin.
It's time to shine. Shine your shoes anyway.
Tony Home Permanent presents...
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you tonight by Burritt Mutual Savings Banks and WTIC. And now your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and welcome to the Golden Age of Radio. And opposite me is an old friend, one with whom I've had the pleasure of working on and off for over 10 years now, Ed Corcoran. Ed, are you expecting a call tonight?
Let me answer it, Dick. Hey, it's the inventor of the telephone, Dick, and he's here with the studio with us tonight.
That's by way of introducing Don Ameche to our Golden Age of Radio audience. Don Ameche, it's a pleasure to have you on this program. And it's going to be a great evening because you have been associated with so many wonderful programs over the years. But I think most people think of you, in terms of radio at least, as being with the Chase and Sanborn Hour, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I guess so. It had the biggest rating of any show that I ever had, although First Nighter, I was on that for 7 years, and it was never out of the first 10. But Chase and Sanborn, the ratings on Chase and Sanborn were just figures that you almost couldn't believe.
You know, Don, it's difficult when we have someone of your stature on the program to confine his career to one medium, because obviously we could talk at length about the stage, about television. We could do how many days on movies alone. But we are going to talk about radio tonight, and so we want to find out where it all began. I know that as far as network radio is concerned, it was Chicago. Is this where it started for you?
Yes. I did a sustaining program. It was the first coast-to-coast show that I ever had. That was in, I would guess, August of 1930. And then I started coast-to-coast on a program called Empire Builders for Great Northern Railroad. And I did that for a year. And before, that started in September of 1930. And then in, I believe, it was either late March or early April of 1931, I took over First Nighter, and I did that until June of 1937, and also in that time I did a show called Grand Hotel on Sunday afternoons for another product of Campana's Italian Bomb. Campana's Italian Bomb sponsored First Nighter. And the only other network that I had in that time, and this is the only soap opera I did, was a thing called Betty and Bob, and I did that for 2 years.
Well, prior to doing these shows, you did study law, I believe, didn't you, at school? And what were some of the early dramatic experiences before radio, Don?
Well, you know, I was involved in little plays when I was in, even as long ago as in eighth grade, and then I went into the, in high school, I did the elocution contest, and in college, the oratorical contest, and I played a few plays then in high school and college, both. And then I didn't do anything for quite a while. I did study law, but not very hard and not very long at both Georgetown University and Wisconsin University. And it was while I was at Wisconsin University that I did a number of plays. I wound up doing a number of plays. The first one was Devil's Disciple, Shaw's Devil's Disciple. And then in the summer of 1929, I was out of law school by that time, and they wouldn't allow me back into the school. I wanted to switch to a Bachelor of Science and major in speech, and they wouldn't allow that, but they did let me come back and play Lelium when I wasn't even in school, and then hired me for the summer to do four shows. And then from there, I went to New York, although I did, in the meantime, I played with a stock company that in Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, how did you break into radio? It wasn't easy in 1930.
I made an audition, that's all. They were bringing Empire Builders from New York to Chicago because their main offices, Great Northern's main offices, were in St. Paul. And they thought New York was too far away, so they switched the origination to Chicago. And they had auditions, I don't know how many people they auditioned, and I won the audition and went on it.
What was radio like? What was Chicago radio like? We haven't had an opportunity to talk to too many people. Was it very active? How much origination came out of Chicago?
Oh, probably more network shows came out of Chicago than came out of New York at that time. I'm talking about the early 30s. We had, some of the biggest accounts that we had. Whiteman, for instance, came from there. The Carnation Hour came from there. Almost every soap opera came from Chicago. What was the name of the agency? Blackett, Sample, and Hummert, I believe. They had all the serial accounts, and they were all out of Chicago, every one. There were times in Chicago, if I remember numbers correctly, I think I used to do something like 26 to 28 shows a week. It was the beginning of everything. All the sound effects were manual, and you had to have a man with any imagination that would be able to create these things, and they did them with every strange kind of device that you could think of. You know, Empire Builders were a stickler for the sound of the train. So they went to this extent. They had a track built, a circular track, that I would guess would have been about 5 feet in diameter, and the rails were exactly, the cracks in the rails were exactly as they were on the regular tracks that trains ran on.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had little weighted cars that they would put on these things that were controlled electrically to go at the speed so that the clicks would be exactly as the same as they were for a passenger train and exactly the same as they were for a freight train. And on the roof outside where they had a microphone that they could open up, they had all the whistles. Out there, they had the ding dongs of the crossings that you'd go through.
Mm-hmm.
They would fade it in, you know, the ding dong, and fade it out as it would go. You know, the whistle would do the same thing. They had a microphone way at the top of a funnel shaped affair for these clicks that came in the thing with the microphone facing down to pick these up.
The thing that amazes me then is that you had so many variables which could go wrong during the course of a live show that never did seem to go wrong, at least as far as
they did go wrong, Dick.
Ed, you have a collection that would stagger the imagination as far as its volume and expanse is concerned. Do you happen to have somewhere tucked away a Betty and Bob by any chance?
I don't believe so. In fact, unfortunately, a lot of Don's early work has not been captured. We don't have any first nighters either, and he was on it for 6 or 7 years. And Grand Hotel, that's another one that has never been picked up. So we don't have some of your early efforts, but we do have one in 1937, and maybe we could do that one.
That would be Chase and Sanborn.
This is something a little different. You made a picture called One in a Million with Sonia Henie and Gene Herschelt, and they had a promotional show they did on radio about the film in which you made your singing debut, and I thought this would be a little interesting to hear how they did this.
Twentieth Century Fox presents a radio preview of One in a Million.
One in a million is lucky enough. One in a million is best from above. While others talk of it, I left it to fade. I never took the chance the odds would you play. I've a conviction that I must be wrong. Strangers and fictions, you happen to know.
It's the show in a million, One in a Million, featuring the sensational screen debut of Sonia Henie, Olympic queen of the silvery skate, whose flashing grace and dazzling beauty has thrilled countless thousands. For her first screen appearance, 20th Century Fox has surrounded her with this great, all-star, all-entertaining cast. Adolph Manjou, Gene Herschel, Ned Sparks, Don Ameche, the Ritz Brothers, Arlene Judge, Bora Minovich and his gang, Dixie Dunbar, Leah Ray, Shirley Dean, and hundreds of singing, dancing, skating beauties. And now our show gets underway with one of radio's fairest favorites, Leah Ray, singing One in a Million.
One in a million is lucky in love. One in a million is blessed from above. While others thought romance, I left it to fate. I never took a chance, the odds were too great. I've a conviction that I must be wrong. Stranger than fiction, you happened along. Though it's a million to one, it is true. My one in a million is you.
Don Ameche, handsome star of screen and radio, plays a newspaper correspondent in One in a Million. And one of his not-too-hard-to-take duties is to write about the new ice-skating queen, Greta Muller, played by Sonia Henie. Let's stow away in their sleigh as Dan Cupid takes them for a moonlight ride.
You know, in America, the boy generally puts his arm around the girl when they go sleigh riding.
They do that in Switzerland, too.
What are you thinking about?
You?
Good or bad?
Well, I'm not quite sure.
Why not?
The first time I met you, I thought you were very nice. But the second time, not so good. Tonight you did something for me, which makes me think that you are, well, like the first time. So I'm a little confused.
You know, my mother once said, Robert, always trust your first impression. It's the best.
I wonder if she was right.
You'll agree, it looks as though they're getting somewhere. Here's Leah Ray singing one of the hit songs from the picture, Who's Afraid of Love? And a pleasant surprise, Don Ameche discloses a grand singing voice in his version of the tune.
Who's afraid of love? It's something we sing about. I haven't the slightest doubt that life without it is cold. Who's afraid of love? What else are we living for? How can anyone ignore the sweetest story that's told? Those who found love know nothing more sweet to hear than the sound of I love you, you love me. So who's afraid of love? It's stuff of which dreams are made, and dreams that make me afraid.
Something we sing about. I haven't the slightest doubt that life without it is cold. Who's afraid of love? What else are we living for? How can anyone ignore the sweetest story that's told? Know nothing more sweet to hear than the sound of I love you, you love me. So who's afraid of love? It's stuff of which dreams are made, and dreams can make me afraid. Afraid of love.
It's the show of a million thrills, one in a million. 20th Century Fox's mightiest musical triumph, with Darryl F. Zanuck in charge of production and featuring the dazzling debut of a radiant, glamorous, brilliant new star, Sonia Henie, in One in a Million.
Barrett Mutual Savings Bank asks you this question. Why should you save? Barrett Mutual Savings Bank will also try to answer. The reasons for saving are almost endless. One, it can open the door to your new home. Two, it can give you the means to new furniture, a new car, a boat, a vacation. Three, it can help send your children to college. Four, it can give you that glorious feeling of independence and prosperity. Don't ever feel that you have to have large amounts to save. At Barrett, deposits as small as $1 are welcome, really welcome. Start now and save for all these reasons and perhaps some of your own. If you can't save a lot, save a little. At Barrett Mutual Savings Bank, where deposits are safe and earn good dividends. Start your account tomorrow.
Member FDIC. You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio on WTIC in Hartford. Tonight's program is brought to you by Barrett Mutual Savings Bank and WTIC. Now, once again, your host, Dick Bertel.
Well, Don, obviously, when motion pictures beckoned, this was in about 1936, I guess.
I went to the coast in 36, yes.
So then your radio work had to originate
from the coast. It
went
out there with me. That's right.
Right.
Went out with me.
And in 1937, about a year later, you were chosen as the MC for the Chase and Sanborn Hour.
That's right. May 9th of 1937 was the first program.
Those were wonderful shows. You were the person everyone was listening to the night Orson Welles scared the rest of America to death. Do you realize that? Because I believe War of the Worlds was on opposite the Chase and Sanborn
Was
Hour.
It really?
Yeah.
Was it a Sunday night?
Yeah.
Yes.
And
I didn't know that.
As a matter of fact, I think they figured that most of America was listening to NBC that night, and so only 6 million people heard War of the Worlds. So you spared a great many people a lot of frightening hours. I did some research, Don, and Edgar Bergen said of you that you were the best ad-libber he'd ever worked with. Can you think of some?
Oh, no. He would say that. Ed was as humble a man as I've ever known in my life, and maybe the shyest man I've ever known in my life. And he would ad-lib with me. I was the only one that he would do it with. And mainly it was not with Ed, it was always with Charlie. Charlie, he used to get a kick out of doing things like that, but Ed was just as good as anyone in the world. First of all, Ed wrote probably 50% of all the scripts that he ever did on the air.
What was a typical week like for that show? I assume it involved a week of rehearsal, writing.
No.
It didn't.
No, it didn't. The writing probably went on all week. But with me, I was limited because I was always doing pictures. So I had a clause in my contract in pictures that said that they had to release me as of noon on Saturday to be able to go to rehearsals. And I never, ever went to rehearsals. We started rehearsals, if I remember correctly, at around 5 o'clock, and we would read through the script, and then we would go across the street and have dinner, a place called Lucy's Restaurant, Ed and all the writers and myself. And then we would come back at probably 8:30, and we would work until midnight. And then I would go home, and I would be back in the studio at 12 noon to start rehearsals again. Now, there were rehearsals prior to 12 noon, but that was mainly orchestra, you know. Oh, we even had orchestra Saturday night, though, too. Rehearsals, because the songs all had to be gone over. And then we would go from like 12 until, if I remember correctly, it was about 3:30. And then generally Ed and I would go next door and have just a cup of tea or something like that. And I would always be back at 4:30 to go listen to Jack's show, Jack Benny's show, because mm-hmm. he was in the next studio and I was quite close to Jack and had a great admiration for him. And I used to love to watch the show, and I'd stand in the control room from 4:30 to 5 and then run out of that and go back into the studio and go on the air at 5 o'clock out there.
There's a story which appears in Jim Harmon's book, The Great Radio Comedians, about you and about your concern over a script that Mae West herself wrote.
Oh.
called Adam and Eve.
No, she didn't write it. Arch Obler wrote the script.
Oh, did he?
Yes. And, the whole history of that. It's a bizarre story, really. It had been done on the air before, that particular script, and done just exactly the way Arch wrote it. But what happened was we started our rehearsals. I don't think May came in until, let's say, 8 o'clock when we came back from having dinner. And I read through the script with her, and Danny Danker was the name of the man who was the head of J. Walter Thompson at that particular time. And I made Cal Cool, who was the producer of the show, call Danny and bring him down to the studio and say that I would not do this script without this line being out. And Danny called me Dago. So we went downstairs. I remember just the two of us. And he read this through, and he says, well, there's no problem, Dago. He says, that's out. So I said, fine, okay, that's out. So I went home, went to bed. I thought everything's all right. Now, Bergen, with McCarthy, had a you know, we always did a parody on the skit that we did. Well, his spot was filthy. So I remember going next door for our little, you know, a cup of tea or whatever it was, and I said, Ed, I think you're a lunatic for letting all these things go on. He says, that's what they want. He says, what am I going to do now? It's too late. So I said, well, all right, accepting that I think it's all wrong. Well, no one ever said a word about that. What the main criticism of what I did was not what was in the script itself. It was that it was making fun of the Bible. This was what it was all about.
I get it.
It went to the Congress of the United States of America. She was barred from radio for life. I don't know that she ever went on again. And I almost got it for life, too. But when all the facts came out and everyone and the fact that it had been on the air before in its entirety without these lines that I took out of the script, why they were lenient and allowed me to continue on the air.
How long did the show last that Jason came out?
I stayed with it for a little over 2.5 years. And then when I left, they cut it down to a half-hour show, and Ed continued for a while, and then I came back and did, I think, about a half a year again with Ed in the half-hour format.
Now, on occasion, you would work with Charlie in one of the skits, wouldn't you?
Oh, I worked with him all the time. Yes, every script, yes. Ed had two different spots. He had one with just Edgar and Charlie and myself at the top of the show. That's right. Nelson Eddy would open the show with a number. I would open and introduce, you know, and then Nelson Eddy, and then that first spot with just Edgar and Charlie and myself. Then Dorothy would sing, and then something happened, and I would sing, and then the skit, anywhere from 10 to 12-minute skit. And then came the parody on this, on the spot, where McCarthy, with every single... there wasn't a big leading lady outside of Garbo and Crawford, I don't think, that was not on that program during that length of time. And, of course, Charlie would just say that... the damnedest things to these to these ladies, and get by with it, by the way.
Because he was Charlie.
Yes, that's
Bergen
right.
Bergen would never say it to himself, would he?
Oh.
He'd never have the nerve to say those things.
Well, Bergen, when he'd go to a party, as we frequently did, Ed, as I told you, was such a shy man. Ed would be, he'd say nothing. We're all strangers to him, you know, he's a little Swedish boy, graduate of Northwestern University with a dummy, you know, this is what he was. And the party would go until finally they'd ask Ed to bring the dummy out. He always brought the dummy. Well, then when the dummy came out, then it was a whole different cup of tea. Then the dummy would say anything to anybody at these parties. Anything. Anything. But Bergen, not a word.
Mr. Bergen, I want you to meet my legal representative, Donaldo Amichola Gazzolo.
How do you do, Gazzolo?
Shut up. Remember, Bergen, from now on, anything you say is going to be held against me.
What's the meaning of all this?
Bergen, I summon up with a case. You pay my climate to Charlie McCarthy only 50 cents a week. That's not enough.
That's not enough, no.
My climate to Charlie McCarthy's got to have $1 a week, right?
Right.
You want to settle? All right. You don't want to settle? We settle you.
You mean you're going to press this suit?
We're pressing the suit that we sponge you out.
Bergen, we're going to take you to the cleaners. That's what we're
going to do. Well, gentlemen, I'm willing to give Charlie $1 a week on one condition.
Uh-oh. Make a note of this, Gazzolo.
Yeah.
Be it mutually agreed that payment shall be made pro rata, part-time, part-payment, per year, per week, per day. Per prosperous rasters.
Hey, look, Charlie, what's he talking about?
Well, I don't know. Before entering this agreement, you both admit that you are of sound mind and body.
Shut up. That's your relatives and Matilda and Inkwood speakers.
He knows his law.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, have you reached a decision? I think we passed it.
Yes.
Well, let me clear this up a little bit. Yeah, just say yes or no. Yeah, all right. Well, what I mean is this. If Charlie is to work 6 days out of seven, he would then receive 6/7 of a dollar, or 85 5/7 of a cent. Figure it out for yourself.
Yeah, 5/7 of a dollar is 52 weeks a year.
Yeah, 12 a month. On a leap year, is one day more. Let me see. Now.
How many days in a dollar? No, that isn't...
Can't squeeze him in the sand, you know?
Can't do it.
What
I'm
going to do is...
Put on shingles. Carry two. You carry two. You carry one and I'll carry one.
Or three.
Six,
look, Charlie, what do you got?
I got a headache. Say, do you think we got a chance, Gazzolo?
Hey, you don't have to worry, kid. If we lose into the lower court, we're going to push him up to the higher court.
Yeah, and if we lose then?
Then we push him up to the highest court.
That's all right, then. Yeah, but if we lose then?
Well, then we push him... We lose.
Don Ameche with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. We'll return to our guest right after this.
Get smile power. The kind of confident, contented countenance that comes from cash. Salted away cash in Barrett Mutual Savings Bank at the highest legal savings bank interest rate. And you don't need a lot of money to do it. You can save a little. It's the constant, patient, every payday habit of saving that really counts. At the Big B, we love your small deposits. We know they grow for you and for us. Result, we will both have smile power. Plus, we help with our high interest rates paid to you on your savings. Barrett Mutual Savings Bank. Deposits insured to $20,000 by FDIC.
I want to find out about the Morgan Ameche Langford Show. Now, I don't recall the show with that title. Now, can you fill me in?
I can't remember the name. I don't know whether it had a title. It was on for Old Gold, and it was in two segments. The first segment was a skit between Frank and myself, dialogue between Frank and myself. Then Francis would sing a song, and then came the Bickersons, and that was the entire program. I don't know how long we were on. I suppose 2 or 3 years. Frank was an artist, as I think everyone recognizes. But he had radio just was a real bugaboo for him. So before every show, we did it in the, what is today, the Huntington Hartford Theater on Vine Street. Before every show, he would go across the street to the Brown Derby, right directly across, and he'd have at least 3 old-fashioned, sometimes 4. And Frank would come back, you know, with that little laugh that he had, and all, and I'd be scared to death, you know. He'd go on the air, never made a boo-boo of any kind, but he'd be half smashed.
Yeah.
And he'd be wonderful. One day he decided to go on the wagon before going on the air. Well, this lasted 6 weeks. He never, ever got through one program without stumbling over everything. And I can remember, like, after the second week, I just used to think, oh, God, I wish they'd go back and have a few drinks. You know? But it lasted about 6 weeks. He never got through one without just bumbling all over the place.
Well, where did the Bickersons originate? Did they have their start by any chance on the Chase and Sanborn Hour?
No.
No.
And it started on a program, and I can't even remember the sponsor of the original program. I know Hedda Hopper was on it. And I don't know, it was for a lotion of some kind. And it was Hedda Hopper, Danny Thomas, myself, Francis Langford singing. Now, if I just give you these ingredients, you know what a disaster this had to be and was. So they called in Phil Rapp. And Phil was the man that created the original Baby Snooks, mm-hmm, with Frank and Fanny Bryce, which was a highly successful program. So Phil fussed around, and he came up with this idea for the Bickersons. And he brought it in, and he thought it would be good for Frances and myself. Well, Frances was petrified. You know, she'd never done anything like this. All Frances ever did was sing songs for the Army, you know, going overseas, traveling, sure, made a few pictures, you know, mostly singing. And she didn't want to do it. But Phil was a persuasive little man, and he talked her into doing it. And that's exactly how it happened, and it became a sensation at that time.
Well, I wonder whether we could prevail on your good nature, Don, and give us some of your snoring here.
First of all, I got a half a cold this morning. Oh, that was funny. There.
Every week I got worse than the last week. How did you keep topping yourself all the time?
I don't know. That's
rather unique about that script, too. One joke seemed to top another. You just couldn't catch your breath for laughing.
No, it was only somebody with a crazy sense of humor like Phil Rapp had. Because we all accused him of these were nothing but things that happened at home, you know, which was not true, of course. But, he was a clever little man.
Here we go, then, with the Bickersons.
I just don't understand how two people can dirty so many dishes. Seems like the minute I get through with one stack, there's another. I tell you, John Bickerson, I'm not going to stand for this much longer. Every one of my friends has made at least one day out of John. John Bickerson, how can you fall asleep at the breakfast table?
It ain't easy with all that talking going on. Wake me in 5 minutes, Blanche.
No, you don't. You just get busy and help out.
I'm tired, Blanche.
That's just an excuse. Did you ever see that sweet young couple next door? Now, there's a husband for you. He waits on her hand and foot.
He's an idiot.
He never lets her do anything alone. On Monday, he washed the dishes with her. On Tuesday, he cleaned the silver with her. On Wednesday, he ironed the clothes with her. What do you suppose he did on Thursday?
He mopped up the floor with her.
He did not.
Well, he should have. Listen, Blanche, I got enough problems of my own, and I'm not interested in that stupid couple next door.
Can't even get you to do the simplest chore.
I do plenty.
I begged you to have the electric orange squeezer fixed. Did you take it to the electrician? No.
Well, I didn't have to. I fixed it myself.
How could you fix it? It needed a new motor.
I hooked it up to the vacuum cleaner.
Vacuum cleaner? Does it work?
It works fine. Except it sucks up the juice and spits the pits in your face. What time is it?
You've got plenty of time. I'll have breakfast ready in a minute.
I don't want any more. This oatmeal is plenty.
What oatmeal? Where'd you get oatmeal?
Now, what kind of talk is that? It was on the top of the stove. I ate the whole pot.
That wasn't oatmeal. That was wallpaper paste.
Oh, no.
You promised to paper the bathroom this morning.
Wallpaper paste.
Now, how are you going to put the wallpaper up?
I'll lick it in place. Blanche, how can you worry about wallpaper when I'm practically poisoned?
Oh, you're not poisoned. It's just flour and water. Go take an antidote and I'll whip up a nice omelet.
I'm not hungry anymore.
Don't be like that, John. I've already got the powdered eggs on. Now all I have to do is chop up the turnips and peel the frog legs. It's a wonderful dish.
I'm not eating any powdered frog's legs.
Just taste it. That's all I ask.
Not me. First time I ever saw green eggs.
That's from the skunk cabbage. I got the recipe from my mother.
It looks like your mother.
What did you say?
Nothing. Look, Blanche, I'm just getting tired of these outlandish dishes you keep making.
Like what?
Like that rhubarb pie you made yesterday.
What was the matter with it?
Matter with it? Who ever heard of a pie 2 feet long?
Well, I couldn't get any shorter rhubarb.
Let's have an understanding now, Blanche. I hate rhubarb, and stop making me 7-layer broccoli cakes and sheep soup.
I never made sheep soup in my life. It's good, healthy possum broth.
Possum broth?
Yes, possum broth. Just because I have a little imagination in cooking is no reason you should pick on me.
I'm not picking, Blanche.
Why don't you come out and say it? You hate my cooking.
I don't hate it. I just don't understand it.
You hate it.
I tell you, I don't hate it.
You do, you do, you do.
Don't I eat everything you make?
Then why do you always get ptomaine poisoning?
Then I'll go figure that one. Blanche, do you mind if I get dressed and go to work?
I don't care what you do. Get dressed.
I will as soon as you finish wiping the dishes with my shirt.
Do you want this frog omelet or not?
No. And stop using my pants for a pot holder.
Well, that's what you use them for.
Just leave my pot out of this. I may have a little flab around my waistline, but I don't eat one-tenth as much as your fat sister.
You stop calling her fat. Clara's a glandular case. The doctor says she's an ectomorph with an overactive thyroid.
I don't care. She's a convertible with a hydromatic drive. She eats like she was condemned.
If you say one more word against my sister, I'll never talk to you again.
I wish you wouldn't tempt me that way.
Oh, you'll pay for that, John Bickerson.
I know it.
You've been tearing down my family since the first day we were married. Never a kind word about any of them.
That's not true. Don't I inquire about the state of your rich uncle's health every day in the week?
You sure do. Every day you say, is the old goat dead yet?
Well, is he?
No. And when he does pass on, you can be sure he won't leave you a penny.
I wouldn't touch it if he did. I may be broke, but I don't want his crooked money. I always wondered how he could travel around Europe on a bank janitor's salary.
He isn't a bank janitor at all. He's one of the shrewdest manipulators in Canada. How do you think he got his title?
What title?
You know as well as I do, my uncle was knighted for his operations in the stock market.
It was the black market. And he wasn't knighted, he was indicted. Knighted.
Well, whatever it was, he's got money and that's all that counts. And that reminds me, I need some money for a new dress.
I can't give you any money this week.
That's what you said last week.
Well, I kept my word, didn't I? Anyway, you don't need a new dress.
Yes, I do. I've been wearing this old rag for 2 years, and I'm ashamed to go out on the street.
Stay home.
Wherever I go, the women whisper behind my back, there goes Bickerson's wife. Look how she's dressed.
For heaven's sake, look how I'm dressed, and I'm Bickerson.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means I'm barely making enough to keep body and soul together, and we don't have any extra money for fancy clothes.
No, but there's always plenty for your precious bourbon.
Oh, now, don't start that again. I never spend a penny on the stuff.
Not much. The whole house is full of empty bottles. Where'd they come from if you didn't buy them?
I never bought an empty bottle in my life.
Well, why don't you get rid of them?
I gotta get out of here, Blanche. It's getting late.
Answer me, John. Why are you so attached to a lot of dead bourbon bottles?
I was with them when they passed away. Goodbye, Blanche.
Wait a minute. How can you go off to work every morning of your life? Goodbye, Blanche.
Now what?
Is that the way a married man acts?
Blanche, I'm not acting.
I'll say you're not. There isn't another man in the world as thoughtless as you.
Oh, dear.
Take a lesson from your friend Mel Shaw. No single morning goes by that he doesn't shower Louise with affection. He wouldn't dream of leaving the house without kissing Louise goodbye. Why don't you do that?
Okay, call her up and tell her I'll be right over. Goodbye, Blanche.
We'll get back to our guest right after this.
Buying a new car in 1972? If so, bank credit may cost you less. At Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, we offer low-cost, convenient auto loans, but we can do more than just put you on the road. We help you establish credit with a bank. We give you cash buyer leverage, and above all, you either start or continue a relationship with a large and progressive mutual savings bank. Once your credit is established, you may want to purchase a new home, improve your existing home, or take a personal loan to finance your trip across the country. Whatever your borrowing needs, it will pay you to start doing business with the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. Once an established Burritt customer with good credit, you become a preferred Burritt borrower. So don't wait. Come into any office of the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
We're going to conclude our program with an excerpt from one of the biggest shows that was ever on the air.
And Dawn made more appearances on this show than any other of the top actors, the Lux Radio Theater, 16 times, Dawn. And
It was more than that.
Was it really?
Oh, yes.
Well, that's
we're
again.
We're
going
to have to get new books.
Seems to me
it was almost 30. And I had there's a little story. The absolute top price on that program was $5,000 for an appearance. And that was Danny Danker. Danny Danker was the man that originated the signatures, the sponsors, the stars sponsoring Lux. Soap. You remember those? Lux Radio Theater was an outgrowth of that. And it was Danny's pet. You know, this was his. The home offices were Lever Brothers in Boston. And Danny, oh, they just adored Danny. What a lovable Irishman he was. He dropped dead, like 44 years old. Out there, and it was always a problem casting people, and for everybody that were paid $5,000, he had to go to Boston and get clearance on them, and that took a lot of time. You know, many of them they would rule out because old man Leverhulme was his name, I believe. He was very fastidious and meticulous about who would go on the show. So Danny came up to me. I think my agent asked $5,000 for me. And Danny came up to me and he said, Dago, he says, I can give you the $5,000. He said, if you'll keep it at $4,500, I don't have to go back to Boston. He said, and get clearance for you, and I'll put you on whenever they don't take somebody else. I said, fine by me, Danny. Well, heavens alive, I was on all the time. You know, for that. This was a story.
Beautiful story.
Yeah.
What is this particular
This ad? Was called It Happened Tomorrow, and I believe it was a movie first with Dick Powell, and then you took over that same role on this particular show.
From Hollywood, your radio theater. A special rebroadcast for all you men and women in the armed forces of the United Nations. Another play from the stage of your radio theater. And here is your producer, Mr. Cecil B. DeMille.
Greetings from Hollywood to all men and women of the American Armed Forces and your allies. We present now another performance from your radio theater, especially for you. The curtain goes up on the opening of our play. Act One of It Happened Tomorrow, starring Don Ameche as Larry and Ann Baxter as Sylvia. It's an event that has never happened before and will never happen again. The Stevens' golden wedding anniversary. Children, grandchildren, even great-grandchildren have thronged to the Stevens' home for the happy occasion. Yes, every member of the family is present. Everyone except the two people responsible. They are still upstairs observing 50 years of wedded bliss, arguing over a manuscript.
But you can't do it. I simply forbid it.
For 50 years you've kept me from publishing this.
Thank goodness I have.
But why? Why?
Because it happens that I love you.
Oh.
And I won't have you laughed at.
But at least let me read it to my family. They'll never believe it unless they hear it from me.
I was in on most of it and I still don't believe it.
Here, you can put it away.
That's better.
I just wanted to read it to them, and then they could judge what happened for themselves.
But if they didn't believe in an old man and...
I was young then, wasn't I? When it all started to happen? 1896. I guess I'd been a reporter on the evening news for almost a year.
And I never even knew you existed.
But you did that night, didn't you? Thanks to William Jennings Bryan running for president. Andy and I had gone back to the office to write up a speech. Just the two of us were there. An old pop thing.
Files, boys?
Yeah, thanks, Pop. Didn't mean to leave them so messed up.
That's all right. Just find yourself another seat.
Huh?
Larry, you're sitting on one of my file albums, right in the middle of 1862.
Oh, sorry, Pop, sorry.
I've been keeping these files just so for 42 years. Look, see this album?
Yeah, sure. It's the file for, what's that, March 1875.
That's right. And this file here, that's for this year, 1896. Well, supposing we're all living in 1875 and I should walk in with the 1896 file. I could tell you everything that would happen, couldn't I?
Just give me the one for next year, Pop, and you can name your own price.
Every year's there, Andy, right on those shelves where I keep my file albums. We may not see them, but they're there, all right. The whole future's there.
Ah, what if we could see into the future? Really see it?
Yeah, just one day in the future. That's what I'd like, Pop. Tomorrow's newspaper, how much?
No, no, Larry, don't ask for a thing like that.
Why, that ought to be a cinch for you, Pop. Come on, let's have it.
I wish I could give it to you, Larry. Then you'd learn it's no good to know the future.
Oh, if I knew where I could get tomorrow's newspaper, I'd give 5 years of my life for it.
You would, huh? But how do you know you've got 5 years?
Go ahead and answer that one, Larry.
I guess you got me, Pop.
Well, there's one thing I can guarantee will happen 5 minutes from now.
What's that?
You and I are going to be mighty thirsty. Come on, let's go. We can have a beer on Park Street.
Yeah, how about it, Pop?
No, thanks. Got a few things to get in order here. Say, I passed that cafe on the way to work. Got some new entertainment there. Mind readers, the poster says Lombardi and Sylvia. Maybe they could tell you the future.
Well, good night, Pop.
A mighty pretty looking girl in that act. At least she was on the poster.
Yeah, they always are, Pop, on the posters. But I can tell you right now, she's full, fat, and 40.
Good night, boys. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, just play Sylvia in a trance. Only my voice, the voice of Lombardi, can reach her. I will require the presence of a member of the audience here on the stage. Will someone volunteer? Any member of the audience? Ah, that gentleman there.
Well, look, you can stay here all night if you want to, Larry. I'm going home.
Look at her. Just look at
her. I've been looking at her. She's beautiful and I'm tired. Good night.
Good night, Sylvia.
Oh, good night. And just remember, 8 o'clock in the morning.
An angel. She's an angel.
And if you're late, you'll be flapping your wings, too. Well, I'll see you tomorrow.
Now, if you will stand here, my friend, and please to tell us, what is the number in the case of your watch? The number, please.
Larry.
Pop. Pop, is that you?
Larry.
Pop, where are you? Oh, Oh, I guess I couldn't see in the dark.
I've been waiting for you, Larry.
You've been waiting? You've been working all this time?
Oh, no. Locked up the office some time ago.
Oh, but it's late. What are you doing around here this time of night?
I wanted to see you, Larry. I've got something for you.
What's that?
This, Larry. Here.
Where's the paper? The Evening News.
That's right.
But I read it. I read it when it came out this afternoon.
Maybe not.
Then I'll pop you and getting yourself a snootful.
No, I wouldn't do a thing like that. Good night, Larry.
Wait a minute. I'll take you home.
No, no thanks, my boy. We go different ways. Put the paper in your coat pocket, Larry. That's it. Don't lose it.
Huh? Pop, I don't...
In your pocket, Larry. Good night.
Good night, Pop.
Morning, Larry. You want to see the breakfast menu?
No, just the usual, Lily.
Hello, Larry.
Well, Joe, how are you? Come on, sit down.
Thanks. Just dropped in for a cup of coffee. Sure is cold out.
Yeah, great weather for Maine. How goes it, Joe?
Oh, not so good. Still looking for a job.
Yeah.
Say, do you mind if I look at the want ads in your paper?
Oh, I'm sorry, I haven't got a paper.
Sure you have. There, in your coat pocket.
What are you... Oh, yeah, I forgot. Here, it's last night's Evening News.
Well, it won't matter. Just the want ads I'm after.
Mm.
Hey, this ain't last night's paper, Larry. It's today's.
Why, can't be, Joe. News doesn't go to press until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's last night's.
Yeah, but what day is today?
It's Wednesday.
But this says Wednesday.
Well, now, Joe, it can't say Wednesday. Hey,
look.
Wednesday. Hey, Lil, what day is today?
Wednesday.
And look what it says here, Larry. Snow. It didn't snow yesterday, did it?
Of course not. Let me see that.
There. Right next to this article about the Opera House holdup.
Bandits steal cash at Opera House while Paderewski plays.
See? It says unseasonable snowfall. A flurry of snow descended on the city at 8 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, it's Wednesday. All day. And what a day. Snow in May.
Huh?
Well, look outside there. It's snowing.
Yeah, it's snowing.
8 o'clock in the morning. And it is 8 o'clock, exactly 8 o'clock.
Say, here's an ad looks pretty good, Larry. They need a waiter at the Excelsior restaurant. Why, that's this place. This here's the Excelsior restaurant.
What are you talking about? We don't need any waiters.
But it says so in the paper. Help wanted. Waiter, Excelsior restaurant.
Well, I can't help what it says. It's a mistake. We don't need any.
Then why waste people's time putting ads in the...
You crazy fool! You get out of here!
That's the last time you'll break any of my dishes. Now get out.
Ah, Mike, have a heart.
I have a heart, but I have no more dishes.
You're
fired. Lily.
Yes, Mike?
Take us some money and go down to the newspaper. Put in, we want a waiter right away. Now, what are you looking so crazy for?
It is. In the morning paper?
No, right away. Put in the Evening News.
Give me that paper, Joe. I gotta get to the office. I'm late. Maybe I'm a whole day late. Goodbye, Joe. Good luck. Bye.
Bye.
Well, now, what's the matter with you fellas? Hasn't anybody seen Pop Benson?
Tell you, Larry hasn't shown up
But
yet.
I gotta find him. Oh, now, look, fellas, if this is some kind
now
of a joke...
Cut it out, Larry. Will you cut it out? There isn't anybody seen Pop Benson. Besides, what's so important?
Well, it's personal. He gave me something last night, and I gotta speak to him about it.
I've got something personal to talk about, too. Get in here, Stevens.
Oh, yes, Mr.
Well, if I see Pop, Larry, I'll tell him.
Yeah, it's awful important, Andy. It's awful important.
Stevens, you're late.
Yeah, I know, Mr. Gordon, but I've been looking for Pop Benson. Something's happened. I don't understand
you
how...
You don't, huh? Well, maybe you can understand this. If you're ever late for work again, you can look for another job.
Yes, sir, Mr. Gordon. Look, who's covering the Paderewski concert this afternoon at the Opera House?
Now, don't tell me you want to be a music critic.
But suppose something should happen there, the biggest news of the day.
You think I'd send you? Stevens, you're either drunk or crazy. Maybe both.
I am, huh? Well, Pop Benson gave me something last night, and if you wait a minute, I'll bring it in and show it to you. You'll change your mind fast enough.
I will, eh? You're fired.
I quit. I mean, I'll quit tonight if you haven't given me a raise.
A raise? Why,
yes,
you...
a raise for being on the job when something sensational happens. You can set up a headline right now. Bandits steal cash at Opera House while Paderewski plays.
Say that again?
Well, what I mean is suppose that something like that did happen. That'd be a good headline, wouldn't it? Bandits steal cash at Opera House while Paderewski plays. And right under it, my byline. I saw it. I mean, I can see it now by Larry Stevens.
Get out of here.
Yes, sir, I'm going. You haven't a thing to worry about, Mr. Gordon. I'll be at the Opera House right on the job.
Well, Don, we've covered some very, very pleasant memories, I'm sure, for all of us. I certainly hope for you. I know for us and for our listeners, because we were all listening to radio when these programs were on the air. It was a very, very important part of our lives. Of course, you're not doing radio anymore, except for some commercials. I guess the Bickersons are appearing on a few commercials from time to time.
Well, they have.
So it's mostly stage work for you?
Yes, practically all stage work now.
Would you say it's your first love, or?
No, I don't. I'm at the age where I don't have a love anymore, Dick. I just feel, if you stop and think how few people have been privileged to be able to get decent recognition in all these media in which I've been able to perform, I just feel I'm so grateful to God that I've been able to do all the things I have, and what a wonderful life I've had in it, and how good it's been to me. The only thing I ask anymore is that I do something that I believe has quality, and I don't ask anything else. This is enough for me anymore. That satisfies me.
Don Ameche, thanks very, very much for being with us, and the best of luck in the future. It's been great for us sharing your career and your experiences here on the Golden Age of Radio.
Well, I'm grateful for your hours of and yours, Ed, for the research that you people have apparently done, because it's given me great pleasure to have these memories come alive again for me, and thanks.
Until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
Tonight's edition of the Golden Age of Radio was brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank and WTIC. Studio engineer Bob Schirago. The program was edited and produced by Brian Hartnett.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camel.